So we're going to start among ourselves and then we'll trial the technology with the iPad in front of me in a moment. But Rachel, I thought I might start off with you and perhaps just reflecting on your read of the survey and what resonated most with you when you read the survey and reflected on what it means for your clients and your own practice.
Sure. I mean, I'd have to say, I think the company Pulse Report is a fantastic document and it is a really good resource for business. A number of the issues resonated in terms of the experiences of our clients in recent times, or not so recent times, as Melinda has told us. One of the key ones that resonated with me is really reflected in the very existence of the report, which is that the expectations of community are moving squarely into what I'd describe as the matrix of key performance indicators for our clients. And what that means, and I always have my legal lens on, is that incorporating community expectations into those performance indicators is becoming the reasonable standard of practice, and a failure to do that meaningfully is no longer a reasonable standard of conduct. And we're really seeing that shift, and that's been reflected by the comments that have been made so far. And in that vein, I'd really say that I agree the law lags behind community expectations, but what we're actually seeing is the convergence of community expectations and legal expectations. And in part, that's because the community is getting more and more able to advocate through traditional legal channels like shareholder activism, AGMs, divestment campaigns, but also litigation. But NGOs that are representing community interests are getting increasingly sophisticated in that regard as well. And we're also seeing it manifest in legal processes, and the Banking Royal Commission has been referenced. It is a stark example. In the terms of reference of the Banking Royal Commission, banks were asked to identify, as well as misconduct, conduct that fell below community standards and expectations. There in the terms of reference. That caused a lot of hard thinking for people like me and teams that were working with our clients on those issues. So a connected issue, though, and this is also reflected in the report, is that unpacking what community expectations are for business can be quite complex. There's not necessarily a single community that is relevant to a business. So you think about, you might have local communities that are geographically based, particularly your mining and oil and gas clients that are so connected to those communities. You also have virtual communities. There are a whole range of different communities that are relevant to business. Those communities may also have quite disparate views. So you have, as we've talked about, 78% of the general public think that business should come out and talk about issues of national importance, which is fantastic. But what should they say? And Alison has touched on this. You look at issues of same-sex marriage and climate change. We would have many clients who would have community stakeholders with very different views on those topics. So yes, you should come out, but how should you come out on those issues? Pardon the pun. I say it as a member of the community. All right, I can make that joke. So I guess the bottom line for me in that regard is that business now need to invest in understanding community standards and expectations in a much more sophisticated way, and they need to develop that skill set if they haven't done so already.
Thanks, Rachel. I think that's a heated agreement with the findings of the survey being drawn out in practice with your clients, which is fantastic. Ken, do you want to give us some views, given your global experience and New Zealand as well?
Yeah, and within the context, Alison, of government. Mm. It was interesting because I went back to compare the Edelman Trust barometers with the findings of the set of work. And it's really interesting to see that in order, really internationally as well as here in Australia, the highest trust is by employers, and it sits with my employer, it sits at around 77%. It's actually higher than the international average, which is 75%. It then moves to a business, which in Australia is 52%, just below the 56% internationally. But the outlier is then trust in government, which is at a far lower level. So it's at 42% in Australia. And the other thing you can see from Edelman is there's a correlation between trust in government and trust in business. So that's a challenge to business when there is a fundamental challenge to government in terms of how it's operating, and particularly how it's operating in what some have described as a greater degree of challenges to liberal democratic principles of pluralist positions rather than hard positions around particular areas on the left or the right. And what we're seeing is this bifurcation of politics, and often a move away from pluralism and traditional liberal values, which then confront that issue about what is in the public interest. And I agree with Rachel, one of the challenges to business, and it's also a challenge to government, the trust in government actually increases the closer you come to the community. So in Australia, it's basically at very low levels at a national level. It's actually higher at a state level than it is at a national level, and it's even higher at a local level than it is at a state level. And so that says to me there is an issue about relating to local communities, and there is a difficulty about defining the public interest, because that's always contestable, and you've raised that issue. The last thing I'd say in terms of Hayne, and obviously we've got revelations occurring with the Aged Care Royal Commission, and we will with the Disability Royal Commission, is that I think the fundamental issues, as you raised, Alison, and I was going to have obey the law, you know, do not mislead or deceive. But I thought the other really interesting quote from Hayne, and it's actually, we often see trust as rule-based, and a lot of the literature talks about trust as simply being the absence of illegality or corruption. In fact, we need to turn that on its head. Integrity is a normative concept. We need institutional integrity that, as Hayne said, basically the more complicated the law, the easier it is for compliance to be seen as asking, can I do this? And answering that question by ticking boxes instead of asking, should I do this? Which are substantively different questions. What is the right thing to do? And there is every reason to think that the conduct examined in the Hayne report has occurred when the only question asked often is, can I do this? Mm. So I think it's really important to move to thinking about concepts of institutional integrity, of not thinking about it as rule-based, whether this is at a political level. You know, it's not about an entitlement. That conception changes over time. When we talk about entitlements, when we respond by saying, well, I'm entitled to this travel allowance, rather than saying, what would be the view of, is this right to take, you know, if you like, this entitlement or benefit? And maybe there's even a problem with the term entitlement.
Yeah,
we need to think very differently.
You want to jump in?
Oh, yeah, in these panel conversations, one of the things I try to do is throw in a bit more data from the report, because there is a lot of data in there. But just two observations. One, I think we specifically asked the question about speaking out based on the Edelman findings. So the Edelman results showed that employees have higher trust in their employers than anyone else. And they concluded that employees were looking for business leaders to speak out. And so that's one of the reasons we asked the question. Mm-hmm. And the results backed it up. But interestingly, employees were quite happy for their business leaders in their companies to speak out. They were more accepting of them speaking out on issues of national interest than of company interest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they actually were more supportive of them speaking out on issues around social and environmental outcomes than things like immigration, taxation and regulation, which directly impacted them, and I think where maybe they think there's more of a conflict of interest potentially, right?
Yeah.
The second point I was going to make is we also asked this question around should a business only... Is your expectation that a business should comply with the law and regulations? Is that enough, right? Or should they do that and look to improve the impact of their activities and do the best they can in terms of their own direct impact? Or should they do A and B and C, which is also then have a view to improving the outcomes of the nation as a whole? So kind of a sliding scale, if you like, of expectations. And the survey results are really interesting, and I'm going to kind of summarise them a little bit of freedom, because the numbers are slightly different to this, but they broadly break down like this. 10% of the survey respondents, so the broader community, said, yes, business should only be worried about complying with the law. And then roughly 45% said business should do that plus think about its own impact, and roughly 45% said, no, whole of nation. So I think that's a kind of interesting kind of divide there, and it resonated with me because one conversation I've had is around the concept of social license and how that's evolving, and the distinction between social license, which is kind of like a permission. You've got your permission slip, okay, that's the bare minimum, and then the idea that companies are now thinking about the social value that they create, which to me is sort of like a bit indicative of that spectrum.
Which again is a fascinating, I think that plays out, I see most commonly at the moment in the climate change discussion, where companies are thinking much beyond the letter of the law at the moment and being quite vocal and backing out with taking decisions even when they're spending shareholders' money to do so. Melinda, the other thing, when you drew out that comment about the public is less trusting of people speaking out on regulations, on taxes and things like that, I find that fascinating, because I think, again, if you go back to the politicians and the commentators that are saying business should just stick to business, I think they would say is, but if you want to speak on social issues, you need to speak on the things that are driving success in your business, which is tax, regulation, some of that. And so it is a complex environment, isn't it?
It's really complex, but in a way that is also the nub of why we've been trying to do some of this work. And it almost goes right to the heart of some of the issues we're grappling with at CEDA. So, one of the reasons that we are so interested and invested in trying to build these connections is, particularly in the business space, we think that the business voice is a fundamentally important voice in the reform conversation in this country. The insights of our leading businesses and business people around what are the things that we need to be tackling to drive better economic growth as the foundation for everything else we need to do, if the business voice cannot be heard there and be credible and influential, then we are not going to get the reforms that we need. And so that's where we're coming from. But equally, the challenge is that when we did the community pulse work last year, we saw the community the narrative around growth is good does not resonate in the wider community at the moment. They are not feeling that they, broadly speaking, have benefited from a generation of economic growth. And there's a whole bunch of complexity in that. But and then if I look at these survey results, if you want the answer to, from my perspective, why the company tax debate has not resonated here, it is exactly in the survey. So many businesses were very vocal about their support for lower corporate company taxes and were very vocal in the reasons why they were, and drew a line directly to investment and then drew a line to jobs. A survey shows you very clearly that the importance of investment does not resonate with the community. They are not believing that that investment is going to make their lives better. And so somehow we must have a conversation in this country which credibly creates an expectation in the community that the benefits will flow to them through cheaper or better products and services, through job opportunities, through ultimately higher wages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where the disconnects are.
Yeah. Melinda, I think one of the other themes that came loud and clear right through the survey results was this overwhelming expectation that we need some change from the community to the business community. So, Rachel, I might go back to you and just, if you had to look at it and say, what's the biggest area where you think the business community needs to listen and change?
I look at that through a regulation and a regulatory activity lens in large part, and I did think it was interesting that the report found such a small percentage of people felt that if business behaved unethically or dishonestly that there would not be regulatory ramifications for that. That's quite concerning and disturbing in a country where we value the rule of law. I also don't think it really is reflected in the trajectory of law reform and regulatory activity that we've been seeing globally and that's reflected here in Australia. As one trend that we're seeing, we are increasingly seeing business regulated to be part of the solution of social issues, and modern slavery laws are a classic example. That is a global trend where business are not being punished, they're being asked to do some non-financial reporting to help identify where the problem is and help then police that problem. The other trend that we're really seeing is enforcement activity that really picks up on a point that Ken is making around getting in before misconduct occurs. We've talked extensively about corporate culture in this country over the last couple of years, and Ken Haynes' Royal Commission really brought that to the fore. But what we're seeing now is regulatory activity like APRA implementing self-assessments on corporate culture. We're seeing the BEAR regime come in. That's just the financial sector. But as Alison said, these learnings are relevant. They are sectorally agnostic. We're also seeing activity like the ASIC Corporate Governance Task Force that again has been mentioned in the reports that came out yesterday, which talk about effective governance, effective accountability. How do you get boards and executives talking about these issues and engaging with these issues and reflecting on non-financial risk in a manner that is preventative? This is space that our regulators haven't traditionally been in before. And we, of course, do have more enforcement funding. We've got the whistleblower laws. So all of this together is a real pressure cooker. When you add that to then stakeholder scrutiny, shareholder activism, corporates are having to lift their game if they were not doing so already. But one point I would make is that regulation, government regulation is one thing, but self-regulation is deep and wide in the corporate sector. There is so much commitment in climate change is a classic example. There is so much commitment by business to go beyond the law, to look at international standards, to make public commitments that then have very real ramifications. That form of self-regulation is a space that we almost say often now, the era of hard law is over. The era of soft law and standards is here.
Thanks. And Ken, public sector, how's the government going to win that trust, do you think, given the lower floor that they're starting from?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned about across the ditch, and if you look at where trust in governments is at the highest level, it's where governments are committed to openness and transparency. Mm. We're still having a debate in Australia as to whether we should release cabinet documents after 30 years or 20 years. If you're surprised, New Zealand release cabinet documents after 30 days. There is a very strong argument, going back to freedom of information, that you get greater engagement, you get greater commitment where people are expecting that they'll be part of a deliberative arrangement. Mm. And going back to your points about company tax, etc., I think the role of companies, the more transparent and open you are, the more you engage with community debate, the capacity then increases to absolutely change people's views. One of the things I was disturbed about was, you know, the lack of community support, for example, for R&D. I mean, that's crucial to create value for the community. So I think one area that we could, I think, work on across government, the non-government sector, and the private sector, is to really understand, I think you mentioned a nuanced approach, that we talk about issues of public value, and it's a simple strategic triangle that really talks about we can't just emphasise one part of the triangle, which is about organisational capability. We need to be clear about purpose, public purpose, and the reason, you know, we are in business or the reason we're being involved in that. And then we need to understand the authorising environment that operates. And unless we get those three things in alignment, we actually can't be successful. Yeah. And it's actually much more nuanced and not as simple, you know, as simply saying, well, you know, we are in this for shareholder value, again, for the purposes that you mentioned. Mm. We're all operating in a nuanced, complex environment, in an environment where people expect to be involved, but there's a responsibility to, if you like, work beyond what I think we've grown up to accept in a lot of our institutions, which is representative democracy, and people are increasingly questioning that. They're increasingly looking at forms of deliberation. And I think ongoing communication, you know, how social media has just sort of taken off, means that people expect to be engaged and involved, They will change their views, but it requires quite a response in an open and transparent environment. Mm.
Melinda, what would you recommend to your members here today in terms of where they should prioritise and focus for change? Where do you think the community is most important?
Well, let me come back to the issue around that, you know, the comments I've made around ethical behaviour. You know, I think, as I said, you know, taking off my CEDA hat and putting on my hat as a company director, and you know, recently on the board of a resources company that was fronting right into the challenges around expectations of climate change and response to climate change and all the rest of it. You know, when I reflect on the focus on community expectations, the focus on ethical behaviour and all the rest of it, I absolutely think that these are conversations that have changed and evolved, and as are the activities and behaviours of companies themselves. Mm. But that's just not getting out there. And I think, you know, for me, the big message, if you look at the fact that employees trust their employees more than anyone else, that is a proximity issue. When you look at where change is being driven in communities, where businesses are working in communities and working with community stakeholders and helping them to drive change. You know, I'm thinking about the involvement of a company like Lendlease in the Justice Reinvestment Program in New South Wales and Bourke, where they've transformed outcomes for the Aboriginal community there through their support of community and working with government. Mm. So for me, it's two things which really resonate with what SEED is actually trying to do, which is one, we can communicate with our stakeholders more directly than ever before. Mm. So think about how you do that. You know, when I presented around the Hayne findings some time ago, and I said, you know, the message for me is that businesses need to demonstrate that they have heard what the community is saying, that they are actually responding to that, and then showing people how they're responding, giving them the proof points. And that then becomes an iterative process. We can do that now. And I think sort of being diligent and forthright and open about that and not pretending that there aren't ever going to be mistakes made, I think that's where it has to go. And then I think the other strong point is collaboration. And I think, you know, genuinely engaging, genuinely understanding how you can work together, not in a jargonistic way, but, you know, in a way that actually delivers better outcomes for both or however many parties is the way to go. And those engagements help you to learn what expectations are. Our survey is high level and broad, and you can read into it many things, and I'm not saying it's perfect. It's a conversation starter. But that it's that direct engagement that's going to really get you the perspective of the people that you need to be working with.
Thanks. The technology is working well. I've got questions pumping through on the iPad here, but we've also got some roving mics. Somewhere, where are the roving mics, people? Here are the roving mics. So if anyone would prefer the old-fashioned way of putting your hand up, like lots of people in the audience, why don't we start with some questions from the floor and then we'll go to the iPad. Yeah, I don't know where, I think you're second in the queue, Rowan. Sorry. Are we coming down to Rowan in the front or Peter, or where are we going? Going to Peter first. Okay. Peter.
My name's Peter Duncan and thanks, by the way, for an extraordinarily interesting pair of presentations and discussion. I've got 1,000 questions, but just a couple. Firstly, as there's now widespread agreement that the duty of a company is to a broader spectrum of interests than its shareholders, do you think that our corporate law should be adjusted to reflect that, as has happened in other countries, for example, I believe in the UK about 10 years ago? Secondly, to what extent do you think that the development of incentive systems over the last couple of generations has been a contributor to some of the, let's call them ethical difficulties in which we've run to in the recent past? And if you do think that, what do you think we can do about it?
Okay, I think the first one, we're all voting that Rachel answers. Rachel.
You know, the director's duties question is a really interesting one. Yes, the UK introduced a statutory duty of loyalty into the Companies Act about a decade ago, and it expressly refers to a range of other stakeholders, etc. And you can see that in a range of other countries too. You know, in Australia, it is now mainstream that the understanding of acting in the best interests of the shareholder and acting in the best interests of the company is not just about financial returns to the shareholder. I think it's very telling that this report actually had a greater number of business leaders identify the importance of equalising consideration of financial, economic, financial returns as well as impact on social and environmental issues, a greater number of business leaders than the general public. The reason that I'm making that point is that the practice of what is occurring in Australia in business leadership is informing the law. So you're seeing judgments come out around what directors' duties are that are increasingly responsive to the reality of the changes in behaviour. So yes, the law is expanding and taking that into account. Do I think that the law needs to be reformed? Well, it could be. I'm just not sure that that much would change because, as we've been talking about, behaviour has shifted so dramatically.
Thanks. And Melinda's volunteered to give us some perspectives on the incentives.
For some sin previously committed, I've had the great delight of chairing a number of remuneration committees in my time. Most recently, I was the chair of the Human Resources and Remuneration Committee at Woodside for about 3 years after we received a strike from our shareholders. So it's been an interesting experience. I have some insights on it. Do I think that incentives can be a problem? Yes, I think they can. And I think, you know, we saw that through some of the findings of the Hayne Royal Commission. If I glance over at Rowan, he knows I'm about to get on my soapbox. This is an oversimplification, but I find it fascinating that when one of our big four banks delivered a net profit after tax result of double digits in a domestic economy that was growing by less than 3% nominally, so they produced an NPAT growth that was four times the rate of nominal GDP growth in a mature market, notionally with high levels of competition, and no obvious example of cost out or whatever, that wasn't challenged about what was going on to drive these results. Now, I'm not saying that that's the be-all and end-all of it, but I just think when you're producing those sorts of results, lifting the lid and trying to understand what's driving that, and then finding out if there is anything that's leading to people to chase profits in a way which will not be acceptable because of the way remuneration is structured, I think is an important thing to be thinking about. There's been a very hotly contested debate around the role of balanced scorecards and all the rest of it. I think they personally think that they are very important and add value. And I think that every remuneration conversation must always be not just about quantitative indicators, which many think are about imposing genuine discipline, but also the qualitative aspects, because we always know that results can be achieved in many, many different ways. So do I think it's an issue that needs to be considered? Absolutely. I have said that I think if you don't look at these things and you don't look at the messages you're sending around the financial performance you expect and the ability to sustain that over time, that you can have as many chief risk officers as you like, but you will never stay ahead of bad behaviour if somewhere you are telling someone that that is ultimately what you want to see. Do I think exec rem is also sitting in this whole conversation, and do I think it's sitting in there in the question about does business ever really get punished for bad behaviour? I think absolutely. Sorry, Ken.
I think using the pun from you mentioned the UK, I think the big issue with incentives is mind the gap. If employees are very supportive of the companies they work with, and with the findings that you had, which was looking at, you know, training, at work balance, etc., the gap issues become important, particularly, you know, as people see huge gaps between incentive systems within, you know, normal areas, if you like, within the company and those that are leading the company.
Yeah, maybe last comment from me on this topic. I feel I've seen a lot of organisations recognise that right down in the bowels of the organisation with really junior staff, they've been incentivising the wrong behaviour and perhaps just incentivising raw sales and moving towards incentivising customer outcomes and making some changes. So I think it's very easy to get caught up in the executive REM conversation, but it's quite often inadvertently sending the wrong signals right through to the very junior staff. That's been a problem.
Can I just say, Alison, I think REM is shorthand for a broader issue. There are lots of ways in which we incentivise behaviour through promotion, through recognition, through... Yeah. So yes, REM is important, but there's a broader issue here which goes to the culture piece.
Yeah.
Now, Rowan had a question down the front.
Thank you. I'm Rowan Mead from Australian Unity. And Peter, you've largely asked my question, but I think it's so important. I'd like to sort of deepen it, and Rachel, put you back on the stump if I could, but this is to the whole question. And Alison, thank you for the points that you made, and I'd agree completely that there is real movement and significant movement across a number of areas of scope in relation to actions about connecting with community concerns and engaging community trust. So let's note that. But on, I think, Ken's point about the normative operations of certain behaviours and integrity, let's think about integrity in this context. I wonder whether or not we've still got lurking in our system something that must be addressed straight on, Rachel, by legislative reform. And that if, without personalising it to either company or to individual, but a moderately famous example in recent commercial history in Australia was the newly appointed chair of the AMP saying the first thing we must do is make more money and make it faster. And the point here, it goes to Melinda's point a little bit about what are the real incentives that are operating, not just remuneration incentives, but whether the board actually is in situ. And while we've had many people in the director community, for example, draw themselves up to their full height and note their legal opinions about the duties of directors to the company as a whole, in truth, when the moment of contested control arrives, those duties are subordinated in our current law to the duties of, you know, shareholders. So must we potentially consider something that actually puts some sort of buttress into corporate behaviour and corporate life in relation to those moments of contested control where fundamentally the culture of an organisation can be determined?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. I guess my view is that the Corporations Act is not the only source of those obligations. And we have in Australia tried to supplement the Corps Act with the ASX Corporate Governance Guidelines, you name it. But they are guidelines, they are not the law. It was interesting going through the ASIC Corporate Governance Task Force review process with a few clients, because one of the issues that it did highlight for me was that discussion around non-financial risk is an area that is not really built into the governance frameworks of organisations the way that there was an expectation that it would be. And you can really see that coming out of the ASIC Corporate Governance report that came out yesterday. So I guess I use that as an indicator of a lag. Even if the discussions are happening, that internal institutional requirements around what REMCO has or what SUSCO has in place to think about aren't necessarily there as examples. There is a lot of law reform coming through that is increasingly holding directors and executives personally to account. I think that's an area that actually the AICD is doing some really good work on this at the moment, that is increasingly coming to the fore. It hasn't been enforced necessarily in the same way, but across a range of different regulatory areas, employment, health and safety, tax, a range of others. At the moment, the Law Reform Commission is having a look at whether our corporate criminal liability regime should be bolstered, including for directors and executives. Should there be more criminal liability? So there is a big discussion about law reform in this country in that space at the moment. I guess my short answer after a long answer is that, yes, you could amend the Corps Act to look something like the statutory duty of loyalty. I just query whether there are other legal touch points and regulatory touch points that could have equal bite or more bite.
There was another question in the audience down the back.
Hi, thank you very much for a very interesting panel discussion and presentations earlier. My name is Kira Labe, and I'm the executive director at the Victorian Agency for Health Information. So health information is probably your tag. I'm interested in the concept that hasn't been raised around shared stewardship going forward in this environment where, Ken, I think it was you who said, you know, that the transparency is an issue and we need to make sure people are empowered. And then I can't remember, Melinda, if it was you who said, you know, in a day and age now with social media, you can't really be one person in one light and be another person in another light. And so I do question what the corporate responsibility is and protect maybe directorship responsibility for creating this shared stewardship employee kind of relationship where if you are asked as an employee to do something that would be ethically unsound to environment or to customer, or how do you go about kind of raising that perspective within an organization to make it even more accountable, not just from the top down, which I've heard a lot about today, but also from the bottom up, notwithstanding the whistleblower legislation that's come in, which is sort of a sad remedy to not listening to people on the ground who are having problems.
Let me start on that, again, kind of wearing my hat from perspective as a board director. This is actually an issue which a lot of companies are very focused on, and it goes to the question of culture as well, clearly, and how do you and how you think about culture and how you assess and measure culture, particularly in a huge organisation, is a real challenge. But there's a whole range of things that people are focusing on and talking about. And first and foremost, as a director, you know, you think about your voice at the board and the message that you send in everything that you do, essentially, in the questions that you ask, in the information that you look at and bring into the conversation and all the rest of it. Each one of these things is a signal about how you're expecting people to behave and the business to behave and perform. But also there are things like employee surveys that you can do where you're understanding, you are asking people directly and anonymously whether they feel that they can raise issues, whether they can challenge people. And then substantively, do you expect that you as an employee, when you raise things, how confident are you that they will be dealt with? Now, these are all signs of exactly that, you know, the extent to which your voice is an important voice and should be raised and should be heard and acted upon when you are raising issues that go essentially to culture and integrity of the operations of the organisation. So, you know, and even things like whistleblower, you know, I know I've been part of a conversation where you look at whistleblower statistics, who's used it, how those inquiries progressed, etc., and conversations about whether you're getting the right number of whistleblower reports. So these are the things, is it too low? Like having none is maybe an example of a bad culture, and trying to understand culturally what the numbers should be in a country like Australia as distinctive with somewhere else. So all of these things are conversations I've been part of at boards, and I think they're part of the way that that you get to that point.
One of the things I've found fascinating in this journey is to reflect on this culture conversation from my background, which was very much in the mining and oil and gas sector, where in today's day and age, safety is such a non-negotiable that the most junior person in the organisation will challenge the most senior person in the organisation on health and safety. And how did they go through that journey? Because when I first arrived in Australia in the 80s, the environment certainly felt very different. And I do think to that point, it started with leadership, but it started on the ground up with reporting and capturing, and then actually taking actions which wasn't punishment but was supporting. And one of the things I found fascinating, which is really hard for companies to manage in today's reporting environment, is my feel of that journey was that the stats got incredibly worse before they got better. Yeah, and absolutely. You had to be able to face into, it's brilliant that the stats are getting worse because it's always been there and now we know about it, and we can't do anything about it until we know about it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I think that we've certainly as an organisation looked at ourselves and also had conversations with our clients is where else can you look for bad news, and how else can you unearth it, and how can you reward people rather than feeling threatened by bringing it forward, because it's only by bringing it forward that you can actually deal with it. And I think most organisations actually in the current environment want to do the right thing and deal with it. So I do just keep reflecting on that history with the mining and oil and gas industry, because I feel like it was exactly the same journey that they lived. And they lived through it and they have been successful, and I feel like it's an absolute given in any company in that industry. And I know, Melinda, you've been there and lived it in Woodside. But
what's an interesting, I mean, one of the things that, you know, people be familiar with, resources companies do all the time, is have safety moments. And I think there are parallels in other areas around having conversations about what happened there, what do we know about that, and trying to move away from, and learning from other companies, you know, well, that happened in that company because they're that company, it would never happen here. And I, again, I think that's something that in all of the boards I've been involved with, you're seeing more of that, that people are looking to understand what's happened elsewhere, where community expectations haven't been met, and bringing that information into challenge whether, you know, you think you're as good as you are, essentially.
Yeah.
It's really important in that context not to be ahistorical, but to understand what's occurred in other organisations over time. It's a big issue of almost when a personal trouble becomes a public issue, and being able to understand that there sometimes are actions of individuals which are inappropriate, but when it affects the culture of a whole organisation, and we're still dealing with that now, if you look at recent Royal Commissions, where the culture in the organisation has been an attempt to cover up, without mentioning specific organisations, rather than accepting that this might be a bigger issue than one individual whistleblower complaining about treatment of, you know, a customer, but where it's a bigger issue. From my own point of view, we were talking before, having gone up to Queensland in the immediate Fitzgerald inquiry, it's interesting to see the difference between what I would say is cathartic response to systemic administration that affected the whole system compared to corruption of an individual minister or public servant or individual officer. And it is very, very different, believe you me, you know, in that environment. So I think one of the issues is how you move from a complainant who might be a whistleblower, who might have an unreasonable or vindictive response, to this is actually quite serious and will affect reputationally the whole organisation.
Yeah, I'm going to move on now, and I'm going to take a question off the iPad for the people who've used the technology. First question here is, from an economics perspective, does capital labour substitution explain some of the disconnect between business and employee views on wages and technology, and are businesses replacing humans with tech?
Well, that's all me. Are businesses replacing humans with tech? Yes, is the answer. But I had a really interesting conversation with someone about technology yesterday, and this is very much consistent with my views on this, is that, you know, as we look at the opportunities here, businesses should be looking to use technology to improve the way they can deliver products and services to do things safer. We talked about the resources. You can use technology to replace humans who have been doing things that are fundamentally unsafe. Going into enclosed spaces to do safety inspections, integrity inspections, it's just incredibly dangerous. So putting a robot in there, great. It's fantastic. Getting a robot up at height so you don't have a fall risk, all that is fantastic. But there's also work that's being done that, quite frankly, is repetitive, and it's the same as when we went through the Industrial Revolution, where we replaced really hard, unsafe work. There are tremendous opportunities there, and there's tremendous opportunities to then focus on the things that make us human, and the things that humans bring to work and all the rest of it. I know that's very much a glass half full, but I think that's where the opportunity space is, and then thinking about how we transition there is the way to go. Capital labour substitution, yes, and you get peaks and troughs in this, and I was having, I'm going to name drop here, I was having an interesting conversation with Peter Costello the other night, and he was saying that he was reminding me that Paul Keating used to boast about the fact that he got unit labour costs down. Getting unit labour costs down because you've got productivity up, including by investing, is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you lift productivity and you can lift wages at the same time, that to me is a win-win. So yes, this is definitely one of the challenges. I think, interestingly, if I join the dots on some of the different pieces of information that we at CETA have collected, when we did the community pulse survey last year, my takeout from that was actually the community was quite ambivalent about technology. They were actually less worried about technology replacing them based on their survey results than I think sometimes is the sort of the public sort of conversation around it. But equally, they were just very uninterested in, or didn't think it was very important to be reskilling, thinking about job mobility or anything like that. And to me, it just struck as just the disconnect is that the significance of this, both positive and negative, is just not really getting the traction in the wider community that we really need it to. And that goes to Ken's emphasis on, wow, research and development. Yeah. So that's my take out on that.
Okay, I've had the red card waving at me from the back for about 3 minutes now, so I'm going to, on that note, say thank you very much to our panel here and invite Angela to the stage to formally thank the panel we've got here with us today.